friends. As the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is why are we here? Now, the question is open to several interpretations, and depending upon the way we interpret the question will be the answer. One meaning or implication of this question, why are we here, is what is that force which has brought us on earth? In fact, in the Secret Doctrine, HBB speaks about causes of existence. And she says there are physical causes of existence and there are metaphysical causes of existence. And one of the most important metaphysical causes of existence is tanha or trishna, that is desire for sentient existence. This is one of the links in the 12 nidanas of Buddhist doctrine of pratitya samutpada or conditioned co-production. So they say that from desire arises craving, and then from craving attachment, and so on till you have jara marana or birth and death. So we are caught in this wheel of birth and death and keep coming back on this earth again and again because of this trishna, tanha, or desire for tenacious wish for existence. Now, many people feel that it is unfulfilled desires or unsatisfied desires which bring us here. But Mr. Jat says it is both fulfilled and unfulfilled desires which tend to, as it were, exert the attractive force, or a magnetic attraction is created in the ego, dragging it back to earth. Now we find this tanha a slightly differently put in Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms, where he describes one of the obstacles to yoga is abhinivesha. This abhinivesha he describes as tenacious wish for existence or clinging to life. This is not ordinary desire. In fact, giving interpretation to abhinivesha, Mr. Judge has put a note there. He says this is a force which is inherent in the spirit itself. It is inherent in the very monad. It is this force which impels everything to evolution. Something which we also get in the Gita, in the 9th chapter, when Sri Krishna says that I emanate these creatures again and again without their will by the power of material essence. Without their will. That is to say, not only human beings, but everything that is there in manifestation is impelled by some unknown force to come back again and again on this earth, and that is this abhinivesha, that impelling force in the very monad which impels everything to higher and higher levels of evolution. Regarding this, we have Jat saying, there is in the spirit a natural tendency throughout a manvantara to manifestation on the material plane, on and through which only the spiritual monads can attain their development. But along with it, in human beings, there is that tanha, which is desire for material existence, desire for sensation, and therefore, that is something which also exerts a pull on the ego and makes it take birth again and again. Now here we see, therefore, that another way of answering the question, why are we here, could be in terms of the law of karma. We are born again. And Mr. Judge, we know in notes on the Bhagavad Gita, he says that there are many people who resort to some special ceremonies and rituals so that they can spend a lot of time in Swarga or Devahan. But he points out that once the stock of merit is exhausted, shine punye martyalokam avataranti. Once the stock of merit is exhausted, you are forced to take birth again on earth. And therefore, what is it that brings us? What is that force which brings us or the ego to earth again? It is unspent affinities and unexhausted karma. When we are born, we forge affinities with people. I think a few issues back, there was this article, Magnetic and Karmic Affinities, in which theosophical views are given that if we hate a person very strongly, or if we love a person strongly, we are creating a karmic affinity. And it is said that among the strongest affinity are found parents. So, it's not by chance that we are born to certain parents or in certain family. In fact, those two people with whom we have very strong affinity, either by hatred or by love, we are going to be taking birth to them. And so also, we come across a few number of people, and that also is a result of karmic affinities. On the other hand, there is unexhausted karma. There is karmic debt which we create when we do not settle the account. There are acts of omission and there are acts of commission. By deliberately doing wrong to another, or by abstaining to do good to another when we should, we create a debt. And likewise, through our thoughts and feelings, and then when we do good, of course, there is karmic reward which we have to reap and enjoy. For both these things, for paying the debt and for enjoying the reward, we again are compelled, the ego is compelled to take birth. Naturally then, the question then arises, is that we are going to be here. There seems to be no escape. The answer is, one hand we talk about Krishna or Tanha, but on the other hand we are also told that the moment, as Light on the Path puts it, that crude wish to live, to enjoy sensation, to have experience, this wish, once it is gone, then that person will take birth only when he wants to. As Voice of the Silence says, he holds life and death in his own strong hands. He can choose to take birth when he thinks humanity needs him. And then once the work is over, he can decide to withdraw. He can decide to leave the body, and so we have instances of sages and saints who take samadhi and they can relinquish this body at will, and there is no longer compulsion on their ego to take birth. On the other hand, the same thing is possible. There is no longer compulsion for the ego to take birth because there are no more karmic debt or karmic rewards. When can that be possible? When we are able to work in such a way that we renounce kartava. Most of the time, anything good we do, we want to have credit for it. We want name, we want recognition. People should know, this is the person behind this work, behind this whole thing, the whole activity, this is the driving force. If that recognition is not given, then I think we are feeling very depressed or disappointed. But when we say and think that I am doing this, that and the other, instead of thinking that I am only the instrument in the hands of the Divine through whom the work is getting done, as we are told to do theosophical work in the same spirit, that it is the Master's work we are carrying on. Once that is there, then there is no longer a kind of bondage created. And the same thing is true when we relinquish attachment to the result. We create karmic bondage also when we are attached to the result. And Mr. Judge goes to the extent of saying that even if it is something good you desire for humanity, probably it has been your wish to work for the blind people, to open an old age home, probably even to spread theosophical knowledge far and wide, all over India. But supposing that is something which doesn't materialize, we don't set our heart on the result. We simply do our work. So he says in the second quotation that it is not ours to say what shall be the result of an action. The law will bring about a result much better, perhaps, than we had imagined. If the passing daily circumstances are not those we expected, then by means of devotion we accept them as just what the law intended. But if we fix our desire on accomplishing even a seeming good result, we are bound by that desire, no matter whether our wish is accomplished or not. So, we can see that it is possible to come to the stage where the ego is no longer compelled to take birth. The third meaning and the answer to the question why are we here is in the sense of whether there is any meaning and purpose to life. In his sort of essay count story, A Hitchhiker's Guide to Galaxy, Douglas Adams has written that some intelligent people built a supercomputer. And this computer was asked, fed the question, what is the meaning and purpose of life? And it is said that after 7.5 million years, the computer churned out the answer. It was number 42. It was completely unintelligible. What to make of this answer? Definitely, the author says, the question is so vast and deep that probably even supercomputer could not understand. So they had to build a supercomputer even to understand the question. Now, all in all, we are trying to say that it is a complex question to which various people have given various answers. For instance, we are told that the theists, they say that the universe and man is created by God, and therefore the meaning and purpose of life is to obey the God and fulfill the divine plan. People like Charles Darwin thought that man and universe are but an accident. There are blind forces which work blindly without a design, without a pattern, and ultimately produce some sort of a design, and accidentally produce something like a human being and the universe. Therefore, it's no use to ask what is the purpose and meaning of life. It's all a chance, randomness. And the third is like Richard Dawkins, who had written the book The Selfish Gene. He thinks that human beings are vehicles, vessels, receptacles of genes, DNAs. So obviously, our aim should be, the meaning and purpose of life is to perpetuate the genes. The philosophers, existential philosophers like Nietzsche, Schopenhauer, and Sigmund Freud, they feel that the purpose and the meaning of life, they are not inherent. There is no intrinsic inherent meaning to life. Everyone has to give their own meaning to life. American philosopher, I forget the name, was very happy to hear this because he said, now at least I can give what meaning I want to my own life. But then it makes the meaning and purpose of life completely subjective. And see what will happen. For some people, being able to go hiking in the mountains gives meaning and purpose to their life. For some people, it is singing and dancing. For some others, it is cooking. For a third person, it could be teaching, which gives meaning and purpose to life. But we know, as Plato says, that there is the meaning of life inherent in it. And yet, we might say that the purpose of life is to gain higher wisdom. Aristotle said that the meaning and purpose of life is pursuit of happiness, and so on. Theosophy would agree with Plato that yes, intrinsically, life is meaningful, worthwhile, and valuable. And the only alternative to life is death. And therefore, if we have to compare, we have to compare worthwhileness of life with worthwhileness of death. And of course, Mr. Judge has said, life is better than death, for death again disappoints the self. So this is something very important. But in order to find out the meaning of life, we have to find out whether the universe as a whole has got some purpose, some sort of a pattern or design. And to that, today again we find the intelligent world, the intelligentsia, seem to be divided into two groups. One group is with Charles Darwin, believing in chance. The other group is what they call as intelligent design theory proponents. This is the theory which is revival of what was put forward by William Paley, the British philosopher, in 1802, when he said that there is a difference between a stone and a watch. You can see a watch is purposely assembled. There is a precise combination of parts. You can see a sort of a design and a pattern over there. So he used to say, if there is a watch, there must be a watchmaker. There must be some intelligence. And today's intelligent design theory people say, whether you believe that intelligence to be a god or call it by any other name, but there is an intelligence and there is design. Darwin, as we said, believed that it is blind forces working blindly, ultimately giving and producing pattern and design. It's like saying that if you give to a monkey a typewriter and he bangs on the typewriter keys, if he does it for 100 years or 1,000 years, probably in the end he will end up producing Shakespearean novel. Now this is far-fetched. We know a monkey can go on typing for eternity and yet he cannot produce a Shakespearean novel. In the same way, from haphazardly and randomly working forces, this universe of pattern and design cannot arise. So Theosophy also says that this whole universe is guided, controlled and animated by almost an endless series of hierarchy of conscious divine beings. And there is a plan or a pattern according to which they work. Now, if the universe has a design, pattern, a purpose for which intelligent beings are working, what about human life? In general, does human life or human beings or human existence have any meaning and purpose? More particularly, does my life, every individual can ask, does my life have a meaning and purpose? Now, obviously we are more interested in the second question. And to that, interestingly, it is found that eminent and successful people, such as Count Leo Tolstoy, Clarence Darrow, are the people who felt life to be meaningless. We know how Count Leo Tolstoy used to always feel troubled about the fact that one day we will die. One day my dear ones will die. And so what is the use of striving or doing anything? In fact, he used to compare his life with the Eastern train. In the Eastern story, there is the traveler. And we are told that this traveler was pursued by a wild beast. And so he runs till he comes across a well. Now he looks inside, he wants to jump. He sees that at the bottom of the well, there is a dragon with open jaws, ready to, as it were, eat him up. But yet he jumps. Because from the cleft in the wall of the well has grown a wild bush, and he hangs on to a solid branch. But as he is hanging on, he sees that there are two mice. They are nibbling, eating away that very branch that he was holding on to. So very soon he knows that the branch will fall and he will be in the jaws of the dragon. Any which way you look, death is inevitable. Meanwhile, he sees that on the leaves which were near him, there were drops of honey. So he starts licking them. As much time as he lives, at least let him enjoy. Count Leo Tolstoy says that in my life, the two drops of honey that I kind of value and enjoy, they are my love for my family members and my love for writing. But ultimately he was sad that one day I will die. So he used to say, so what if I learn to write as well as Pushkin? Probably he looked up to this Russian writer Pushkin. And he says, supposing I wrote as good as him, ultimately what? With death, everything will vanish like a torch dipped into water. But our achievements are not lost with death. And he says that this is how other people are also viewing life. As long as they are alive, they are running after pleasures. Eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we will die and who knows. So let's enjoy ourselves. And this is very, very true about our today's world. We want to seize as many pleasures, as many enjoyments as we can get through food and clothes and movies and whatnot. But we are told that with death, everything does not come to an end. Things don't vanish. In fact, here again we see, as it is pointed out, that the universe exists for the experience and emancipation of the soul. So, yes, to human existence also there is a purpose and there is a pattern. First of all, the universe itself comes into existence according to the law of periodicity. And the universe comes into existence depending upon the karma of the people who are now on the universe. What was their karma created on a previous universe? And so the law of karma and the law of periodicity, they work and govern the appearance of the universe. The same thing also governs the appearance of human beings. We are governed by laws of karma and reincarnation, rebirth. And we are told that therefore, depending upon what karma we have created, we get the life. And of course, if something is remaining and what new karma we create in this life, we carry forward in the next life. So, this is the law which is governing both human beings as well as the universe. We are also told that human beings are endowed with the power to think, power to choose. We can choose to go against karma, we can against the law of karma and harmony, or we can choose to work in harmony with nature. So depending upon our thoughts, our feelings, our karma, depending upon in what direction we exert, we go to Devahan, and like a bee gathering honey from flower, we take aroma of all the noble qualities and experiences. If we had been kind, if we had been good to others, that effort, that goodness is not lost. We take, the ego takes it with itself to Swarga or Devahan, and therefore in another life when we come back, the ego comes back enriched. it comes back enriched with these qualities. It comes back enriched with every effort it made to understand mathematics, understand architecture, understand the way of cooking. All those pursuits, the seeds, the germs of it we take. So the achievements are not lost. And by doing that, ultimately, we are told that the ultimate purpose and meaning of life is to realize who we are and to also know that we are none other than the Buddha and the Christ. Of course, potentially we are divine and we need to actualize this potentiality. So all that we do is try to actualize or realize what is lying latent and potential within us. And in doing that, we will require experiences of life. Now, again, that question arises that, yes, we understood the human existence is for self-realization and liberation from this wheel of birth and death. But does it mean that because we participate in life, our life becomes automatically meaningful and purposeful? Not necessarily. In fact, for most people who do not understand the plan, the pattern, the purpose of existence, what is life like? It's a humdrum existence. It's like the myth of Sisyphus. In the myth of Sisyphus, we know, because Sisyphus, like Prometheus, he had divulged some divine secrets to human beings and therefore he was being punished. And his punishment consisted in Sisyphus having to roll a huge boulder right up to the top of a mountain. Once it reached there, he has to release it so that again it will roll down. Again, he has to roll this boulder up to the top and again it will roll down. So on and on and on. Now this, of course, there are various interpretations, and one interpretation is that it just shows the will and the readiness of a human being to try one more time in the face of a failure. But the obvious meaning is that it signifies or represents a sort of futile, hopeless, monotonous, mechanical labor or activity. Many times we feel life to be very monotonous, futile and hopeless because we don't keep at the back of the mind the meaning and purpose. So we feel, what is it? I get up in the morning, I brush my teeth, I have my food, I go to office or I cook or I go to college or school, come back and then go to sleep and again get up, again repeat the activities and endlessly, interspersed now and then by some short time goal which I try to achieve. First I want to get my degree, then I want a particular job, then I want a promotion, then I want to get married. And then I want my daughter and son, and then I want them to get married. And so there are short-term goals we look forward to. We think it is worthwhile to go on so that there is this desire to be fulfilled or some goal to be achieved. But the moment that goal is not there, we begin to feel a sort of emptiness. We begin to feel life is not worthwhile. And what is it? Cooking the day in and day out? Or filing papers if I am a clerk in the office? Or just writing down something? Or taking dictation and typing on the typewriter or on the PC? And so on. It's the same old thing which I go on doing. Does it mean that, as we often feel, that life can be worthwhile, meaningful, purposeful only if you have some dominant goal or a dominant cause to serve? So for most of us, the feeling is life of Mother Teresa or Gandhiji, or Thoreau, or Abraham Lincoln, yes, their lives are very meaningful lives. After all, they worked for humanity, no doubt about that. But by no means life of a sweeper or a garbage collector, or life of a tune in the office, or a nurse or a doctor, or a teacher is, or even a simple housewife. It's not a meaningless life. Because we are told in theosophy that it's through the daily duties, small plain duties of life, that we can make progress. And we know how that pupil asked the sage, that you give me anything to do, in fact give me a most difficult task to do, I'll be happy, but please don't ask me to do these repetitive things which I have to do every day, sweeping this place or arranging the books, please don't give me, it's so boring. And the sage says, you know, in fact the universe is kept going by these repetition tasks which is done by most people, and the whole of nature. Has any time sun cribbed and said, I have to rise in the east and set in the west? It does it. There is ebb and flow of tide, and so on. Everyone seems to be their repetitive duty, and that's what keeps the world going. And that is the best way we can give our contribution. By not cribbing, by not complaining, but in fact cheerfully and carefully performing the littlest work that we have. Consider it as your own contribution. And that is the sure way of progressing. So, in the next quotation, before we go there, in the previous quotation we have been told that before we come to this stage, there has been a journey. There has been a journey of going through the lower kingdoms. And it's a very important point for us to remember that it's, if the universe exists for experience, we have been doing just that. We were speaking about ego or monad. We also call it as eternal spectator, eternal pilgrim. There is something in man which, as it is said, was before the stars, which was before the sun, and it is going on the journey, garnering experiences in various forms, form of a stone, a plant. And this is the idea which is there in the Hindu philosophy of passing through 84 lakh yonis. And also in the Kabbalistic and Sufi aphorism, it says, I died as a stone and became a plant. I died as a plant and became a beast. I died as a beast and became a man. When did I grow less by dying? I will die as a man to give birth to an angel. So, in order to become what we are potentially, a Buddha or a Christ, we make a small beginning by doing our everyday duties with perfect concentration, attention, carefully and cheerfully. So the next quotation says, they must aim to develop themselves in daily life, in small duties. We cannot all wear the conqueror's crown of wild olive or the martyr's palm, but we can all do the small duties of life thoroughly well, and the small duties require the exercise of the same virtues as the great ones. A child does not learn to walk by climbing a mountain, but by taking one step at a time upon a level floor. And it is these small duties which will fit us for higher duties. We will come to a stage where we also can work like Mother Teresa or Gandhiji, or work on a large scale for other people. But first, have we learned to do our small duties well? And of course, as we said, life of every person is meaningful, because life is a drama, and we know that in a drama, the success of drama depends upon every character performing its part properly.
We won't read the next quotation, but HPB says
that this ego in man, this soul, plays variety of roles. Our personality is the role which is being played by the ego, which is the real actor. And in this life, I am Miss X. In last life, I could have been Mr. X. In the next life, I will be somebody else. In a given life also, we are all playing our roles. We play the role of a mother, we play the role of a teacher, we play the role of being a sweeper or a sister. And as we said, no role is insignificant. After all, what comes to our mind is this very, very touching story, but we've said this, we've shared this many times. It's from Chicken Soup for the Soul, about a little boy called Jimmy. Now, there was a drama going to be there in the school, and his heart was set on participating. He wanted to take part there. His mother knew that he's not so good in acting, so he's not going to be selected. So the day of selection came, and mother went at the end of the day to fetch the child with lots of apprehension in her heart. She thought he will come crying, disappointed. Instead, what did she see? He came running with his eyes shining, fully excited. "Yes, what, Mom?" "I have been chosen. I have been chosen to clap and cheer." Now that was very thoughtful of teacher, that instead of saying, "No, you are not chosen, you are not given any role," she said, "You are given a role, and your role is to clap and cheer." True enough. Fair enough, because if everybody is participating, we require audience to cheer, to boost, and so also in life. For the smooth functioning of our lives, do we not require a sweeper, a garbage collector, a teacher, a nurse, a pharmacist? If they go on strike one day, we are in soup. So, there is no role which is insignificant. As we play the role, we are learning the lesson. As we play the role of a mother, till the girl is not married, she knows nothing about motherhood. And it's so easy to say about mothers, "Arey, you should do this, you should do that." When you become mother, you know that it's not so easy. There is a different kind of attachment formed. It's so easy to comment on a person who is a teacher, who is a manager of the company. The clerical staff will say something, "Arey, he is worthless, he can't take decisions." Everything, every role that we play, we are learning something. And so we say life is a school. And in fact, this is one most important thing, whether we understand anything else or not. It is so important that many times there are situations where people feel, what is the meaning of this life? And by that they mean a person who is terminally ill, a person who has gone insane, a person who is an idiot, a person who is paralytic for life, a person who is bedridden, a person who is in coma, who is in a vegetative state, people who are in a what is called as lock-in syndrome. They are not even aware of anything. They are just fed, I think, through tube. But you feel, what is the use of prolonging this life? And therefore, a lot of debate goes on. Even in India, it was there, mercy killing. Active mercy killing and passive mercy killing. Well, theosophy would say, if nothing else, one dominant meaning and purpose of life is learning. Life is a school, and learning is the process which goes on, no matter in what situation you find yourself in. You may be in a vegetative state. You may be insane. You may be an idiot. So, seemingly, there is no use. Of course, you are not able to do anything, but the ego is learning. learning what it is to be trapped in a body, learning what it is to have the body and not be able to use it. It's a huge disappointment for the ego. Some karma has brought this kind of a situation, and the learning must take place through this kind of a situation in this life. And we are not going to deprive them. HBB says that, who are we to decide the worthwhileness of life and worthlessness of life? Among certain tribes, there are people who put to death their old people with warlike honors. Because they are crippled, they are old, they are of no use, so they are put to death. We can't do, we should not do, because there is learning. And therefore we can see that whatever situation we are in, if we have come to the fag end of life, we have done all, we have seen all, we have achieved all. Many people, especially when they come near the old age, they say, what is the use of my life? Well, one, if you are moving around, you can be of help to anyone, anytime, who knows? Secondly, if not that, even there is learning. With every moment there is learning going on, up to the very last breath we are learning something. So, first learning is that whatever situation, especially if it is an irksome work, if it is a painful situation, then the first thing that we learn is not to complain, grumble, get irritated, do all in your power to change it, but if not, accept it. Accept it with resignation, a positive resignation, to do the very best in that situation. And sometimes, as we've often given examples, people turn that situation to their advantage, so much so that other people would emulate them. A person in a poor surrounding, sometimes we read of a person who is a doctor. He was born to a prostitute. He used to read under street lights and went on to become a very successful doctor. Triumph over the situation and not allow the situation to triumph over. Such people can really set a shining example for others. And so here Mr. Crosby says, in the great economy of law and nature, each being is exactly where he needs to be to eradicate defects. All necessary conditions are present for his growth. The only question lies with him. Will he take them as pain or as opportunities? If the latter, all is well. He is bound to conquer, whether the way be long or short. The purpose of life is to learn, and it is all made up of learning. The various conditions that confront us are opportunities and means afforded us to increase our discrimination, strength, and knowledge. So, it's up to us if we realize that life is a school and made up of learning, and especially there is learning through adverse and painful situations rather than through comfortable and happy situations, we will then be able to handle pain properly. And also, life is a pilgrimage. So, there is a article in Echoes from the Orient where Mr. Jat says that the whole life's pilgrimage, in fact, the outward pilgrimage, going to Kashi, going to Badrinath, Kedarnath, all this is only symbolic of the pilgrimage through which we, our soul, our ego is going through. And we go to a pilgrimage place to be in closeness to God. But that pilgrimage reminds us to take up a sort of investigation of our own nature and find out who we really are. So, this scientific investigation consists in understanding, in meditating and knowing that I am not this body, I am not my money, I am not my wealth, I am not my name and fame, I am not my ideas, I am not my feelings, I am that. And that gradually, through experiences, the attachment for the body, for the name, fame, idea, attachment, it will go on lessening. And that is why we require so many lifetimes, life after life after life. Through various kinds of experiences, we come to a point where we know who we really are. Look inward, thou art Buddha. And in the process, just like it happens on pilgrimages, there are difficulties, there are trials, there are tests in life. And one pilgrim helps another, so also we help each other. It's not just the idea to selfishly come to a self-realization of who I am and liberate and take moksha, but help other beings. So, again, one of the dominant purposes, if nothing else, is to be of service to others, but even otherwise. As we live, as we saw last Sunday, if we can be careful of our thoughts and feelings, if we can encourage ennobling thoughts, every time the thought of hatred or jealousy comes in the mind, we try not to lend energy to it, then we will find that every single atom and cell in our body, that anything that comes in contact with us, as it were, it will be charged with a very good magnetism. And it is in fact said that those atoms that we impress with thoughts of anger, jealousy, hatred, violence, these atoms go to form bodies of those lower animals. So today, if tigers have become more ferocious, serpents have become more venomous, it's because of us. In fact, the duty of man, in fact, Hindu philosophy talks about various kinds of renters. We owe debt to the whole of creation because we are getting something from them. The debt that we owe to the lower kingdoms is that when they come in contact with us, we give them such impression that we raise them to higher and higher level. These atoms which are now forming the human body, if we give them good impression, they will not go back to animal or plant or a stone. For instance, if we are lethargic, if we are lazy, we bang the broom when we are asked to do the work. The lazy kind of impression is given to those atoms, and these atoms will go to form a stone or some sort of a thing in the mineral kingdom, the lower, not even a plant. And then similarly animal bodies. But we should really raise them to such a degree that they form human bodies. And ultimately, all these atoms are on their way to becoming self-conscious thinkers like man. One day they have to graduate and come to the stage of being a human being and like us, realize the Buddha within. And therefore, in the next quotation, we are told that the life is for experience and emancipation and for the purpose of raising the entire mass of manifested matter up to the stature, nature and dignity of conscious Godhood. They also, it's very difficult to believe that a speck of dust will one day have to come to the stage where it will realize consciously, I am verily the Brahman. That potentiality is locked up even in that speck of dust. But we have to aid them and raise them higher and higher and higher. Well, as we said, ultimately, if we say, why are we here? We are here to help all who come in contact with us to take a step forward in their evolution. Because if this life is for the emancipation of the soul, we have to help others likewise to gain this liberation. Nobody likes to be caught in the web of wheel of birth and death. So we are here, at least if we can't see anything else, we just help. And how do we do that? Robin Sharma says, every single one of us is here for a reason, a special purpose, a mission. Build a beautiful life for yourself and for those you love. Make your life matter. Be of use and be of service to as many people as possible. This is how each of us can shift from the realm of ordinary into the heights of extraordinary and walk among the best who have ever lived.